All right, welcome everyone to a new episode of the Roscoe's Wetsuit Neuro Podcast. I am your host, Toby Passman. On the show with me today, we have a special guest, Doug Knoll. Doug is an award-winning author, speaker, and trainer. After 22 years as a trial lawyer, Mr. Knoll became a peacemaker and mediator. Today, he helps people solve deep and intractable conflicts and teaches others to do what he does. Mr. Knoll is an adjunct professor of law at the Pepperdine School of Law, Strauss Institute, where he teaches decision-making under uncertainty conflict. Mr. Knoll is the co-founder of the award-winning Prison of Peace Project, in which he teaches murderers in maximum security prisons to be peacemakers and mediators. Mr. Knoll has trained mediators and leaders in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia in his innovative peacemaking and mediation processes. Mr. Knoll's honors include California Lawyer Magazine Attorney of the Year, a Purpose Prize Fellow, and Best Lawyers of America Lawyer of the Year. And he's also written 4 books, the latest of which was released in 2017, titled De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. Doug, I could keep going, but I think that'll suffice for an introduction. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, I know. The CV gets a little long when you've been living for a while.
So what originally, like, what... You, it sounds like just you've had a very interesting life and career. Tell me about your path. Like what originally, sure. So you were a trial lawyer, and then what happened?
Well, actually, I'll tell you the story. I don't normally tell the story, but since you asked me, I'll tell you. I was a trial lawyer for 22 years, and I entered the bar in 1977 and clerked for a judge for a year, and then started in private practice as a young associate in a mid-sized Central California bankruptcy litigation firm. And they groomed me to be a trial lawyer. I started with that firm in September of 1978 and tried my first jury trial in November of 1978. And then in December of 1978, spent 6 months in San Diego trying defending a $36 million securities fraud case, and which we won. And we successfully defended, and we won $3.5 million on our cross complaint. So they set me up to be a big time business, complex business, commercial trial lawyer. And so that's what I did for the next 22 years. Along the way, in the 80s, I started studying the martial arts and eventually earned my second degree black belt when I turned 40. And then my teacher kicked me out. He said, "You're too arrogant, too much of an asshole lawyer, secondary black belt. Go learn Tai Chi." So I didn't know what Tai Chi was. Old folks in the park, you know, doing this floaty stuff. Well, it turns out that Tai Chi is an extremely vicious martial arts. It's the origin of all martial art. And one of the things that was most interesting and profound for me was that there's a paradox in Tai Chi that says the softer you are, the stronger you are, the more vulnerable you are, the more powerful you are. Soft to be strong, vulnerable to be powerful. Did not compute for a long time. But finally, one day, I kept practicing, and I really enjoyed Tai Chi. It was very, very intricate, and takes a lot of concentration. It's really an interesting art. So I was in a courtroom one day, and the thought came to me, what the heck am I doing in here? It just came to me out of the blue. Finished the trial, went on a whitewater trip with a bunch of friends, and I've been a whitewater guide for 30 years at that point in time. So we were all going down the main salmon in Idaho in our rafts, and I was by myself. I just had 10 days to reflect on my career so far. And I ultimately decided that I had not served that many people as a trial lawyer, even though I tried over 200 cases and won most of them. But people were not coming out of the system better than when coming in. And I just decided I didn't want to do that anymore. So as it turns out, when I got home, I was driving down out of the mountains to my office and heard a public service announcement for a new master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies. And it caught me. And it was being offered at the West Coast Mennonite University, which happened based in Fresno, California, Fresno Pacific. And so I enrolled, and they accepted me, which I was a little surprised. Not that I was academically well qualified, but being a lawyer and a trial lawyer in a peacemaking program, I'm sure they had their moments. But as it turned out, I was the one of the best students they ever had, and it was amazing. So I got into the program, and I learned all about human conflict. And I had some incredible teachers, and they taught me stuff that I'd never been exposed to before, looking at conflict from theology, from psychology, from neuroscience, from philosophy, all these different ways of looking at human conflict and history, and it just really opened my mind up. And I made the decision that I wasn't going to be a trial lawyer anymore. So I had a lot of discussions with my partners. A lot of people thought I wanted to open up a peacemaking practice, a solutions practice, not a litigation practice. And at the end of the day, they couldn't bring themselves to do it. So I left. And in 2000, I opened my own mediation and peacemaking practice. In 2004, I was mediating a case in Santa Barbara, California, this divorce couple. And I had never seen people so angry at each other. I mean, they were screaming vile insults at each other. If they'd had knives, there would be blood on the floor. And I didn't know what to do. I'd been trained in how to deal with conflict, but none of the real skill techniques I'd learned really worked very well. So the thought came to me, listen to the emotions. And this was probably just in a crisis moment, all my neuroscience training kicked in and realized that maybe emotions are the key here. So I had them listen to each other's emotions and reflect them back one at a time. And within an hour, they had completely calmed down. When they were all done exchanging their stories and reflecting, the guy looked across to his ex-wife and said, "That's the first time you've listened to me in 25 years," and started crying. And they settled the case in 5 minutes. They realized how stupid it was and walked out holding hands and had lunch with each other. And my jaw was on the floor. What just happened? So I started fiddling around with this idea of listening to emotions, and it was working for me in my mediations. And in 2004, I mean 2007, 3 years later, Matthew Lieberman, a neuroscientist at UCLA, came out with a brain scanning study that I read the study and I said, "This is exactly what happened to me in Santa Barbara." And he had figured out through brain scanning fMRI studies what actually was going on in the brain. And then, he didn't understand why. I think I later figured out why because I follow the work of Lisa Feldman Barrett, a neuroscientist out of Northeastern University in Boston. And she's got some really amazing stuff. But by connecting all the dots, I finally figured out what was really going on and why this idea of affect labeling really works. But I was still getting a lot of pushback and skepticism. And so in 2010, with my colleague Laurel Coffer, we started the Prison of Peace Project. And basically, we started teaching 15 lifers, women, who are serving life and long-term sentences in the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, how to be peacemakers and mediators. And we taught this as our very first skill, this idea of listening to emotions. And for 8 weeks, I mean, they were learning, but in the 8th week, we came into the training room where the women were. And we witnessed an amazing transformation. They went from black thorns to beautiful roses, completely transformed personalities in people. I mean, unbelievable. We thought that was pretty remarkable. Well, the word got out in the prison as it does, and pretty within a week we had a waiting list of 300 women. So we spent 3 years working in that prison, training up a cadre of mediators and peacemakers and people. And then the prison was repurposed to a men's prison, and we were invited, and at first said no, but eventually we agreed to go in and teach the men and had the same exact experience with the men that we had with the women. And today we're in 15 California prisons, a prison in Connecticut, 15 prisons in Greece, and we've got startups in Nairobi and Italy. Of course, we've been on hiatus during the pandemic, but we're now in the process of videotaping our entire curriculum so that all our students can have access to the lessons, whether we're there or not. And that was where I really acid tested this in some of the most difficult circumstances you can imagine with some of the most difficult people you can imagine. And it worked like a charm. It was the inmates who asked me to write the book because they were so profoundly changed by this idea of affect labeling that they wanted something that they could have their parent or their families read outside and learn from. So I wrote the book and it was published by Simon & Schuster in 2017. Now it's in four languages. It was a bestseller for a while, so it's done really well. And it kind of lays out the basic concepts of how to listen other people into existence, which is how I describe what this is all about. And today I make I'm 70 years old and my life is devoted to teaching as many people as possible these skills because I have seen the transformations that it makes in people's lives.
So I'd love to hear, like, what are some of the components of teaching peacemaking?
Well, I guess it depends on what kind of peacemaking you're talking about. What we learned in the prison project was that Laurel and I made the assumption that walking into the prison, we're going to be dealing with a population of people who have zero skills. That's why they're in prison. They're emotionally unaware. They can't self-regulate. They have no empathy. They have no problem-solving skills other than through violence. They just lack a lot of skills that we assume that people not in prison have, but it turns out that's a false assumption. People outside of prison don't have any better skills than the inmates did. It's just that the inmates were more abused, and that led them to violence and other stuff. So basically what we do in the prison project, and what I would do teaching anybody who wanted to be serious about learning to be a peacemaker or a mediator, is first of all, teach them how to listen. Four levels of reflective listening, learning how to paraphrase or to mirror, paraphrase core message and affect label, and really dial that skill in, because listening is the key to everything. And then we teach people how to run peace circles, or call them listening circles, which is a process for talking about difficult subjects. Then when the inmates graduate from that, then it's time to teach them, give them some advanced training in how to create a durable agreement. How do you get people to agree to something and then actually get them to do what they say they're going to do? How do you help people solve problems without giving advice? And then how do you manage strong emotions? And finally, how do you morally re-engage people who are morally disengaged? Obviously, in prison, that's a pretty big issue. And finally, when they've gotten through all these workshops, they're ready to learn how to mediate. And we take them through a three-day workshop and teach them what most mediators would recognize as a pretty standard mediation curriculum that you'd find in any community mediation center, interest-based mediation. And they got a lot of homework to do. It's a hard curriculum. We're graduate professors and we hold these people to the same standards we hold our graduate students. And so that's the basic process. And then for each skill that we teach, we break it down. We're all about teaching the how. So we have a breakdown. This is how you do it. So we explain it, we demonstrate it, we have them do it, and then we debrief.
What were some of the biggest challenges for you, like working with these people, trying to teach, like as you were talking about people with, you know, little to no skill at what you're trying to teach them in terms of the conflict resolution? Like, was it?
I didn't have any real challenges with the men. I found the men to be easier to teach than the women for a lot of different reasons. And it's not about the gender or sex. It's just how the prisons are structured. Because the men's population is so much larger. I mean, in California, there are 120,000 people behind bars. It's crazy. It might have gone down a little bit, but it's somewhere between 110,000 and 120,000. But the men are all segregated by, you know, the propensity for violence. There's a whole scoring system. So men tend to be pretty homogenous populations. The women, much smaller population. They're not homogenous. A murderer could be bunked with somebody who was in three strikes because she stole Twinkies because her family was starving. So the women, you don't know, and they don't do a very good job of separating out the mentally ill from the non-mentally ill. So with the women, the population group was just much more difficult because you didn't know what you were getting. The men were very homogenous. The challenge with the women for me was that I'm a large, tall, 6'1", 220 pounds, white, Anglo-Saxon male. And I represented them to everything that ever had been done evilly, to every evil that had ever been perpetrated on them. That's what I looked like to them. So it took a long time to build trust. In fact, there was one point where I learned later, a woman, a professional woman, came up to me and started cussing me out. What the f- you doing in here, and who that you think you are? I mean, she was in my face. Turned out she was the prison psychologist, the head psychologist for the prison. And she just got triggered by my presence. So it took me a long time to learn. I learned humility. I learned how to really refine my listening skills and really be present for them and really be emotionally safe for the women. And that was a real growth experience for me. And I was 60 years old when that thing start, when that started. So it was a real wake up call. The men were, as I said, a lot easier. And we, you know, the thing is, we go into these really deep, dark places. We never, ever, ever have had a problem, a security problem, anybody. What happens is the inmates, because you're doing something, they recognize the value of what we're giving them. They become intensely loyal. And they'd lie down for us. I mean, if anybody ever gave us any problem whatsoever, they were out the door, you know, thrown out. Don't come back. So it was pretty cool.
So can you talk to me about like some, like what are some, I guess, tips or can you just give me some of the substance in this program?
Sure.
As far as,
well, like, let me talk, are, let's talk about what skills. The core of all of this is in a listening skill called affect labeling. And in affect labeling, we do something very different than what people have learned. And that is that we learn how to listen to and reflect emotions. And that's what the Lieberman study showed. When you reflect back emotions, the brain processes that information in a very different way. So the skill breaks down into three steps. Number one, when you, let's say you're confronted with an angry or an upset person, an emotional person. The first thing you're going to do is ignore their words. It doesn't matter what they say, you're just going to ignore it. It's white noise. And you ignore the words because, for the most part, there's no news there. We've heard it all before. And you want to free up some bandwidth to be able to do the next two steps. Step number two is to read the emotional data fields of the speaker. And that turns out to be pretty easy because we have innate brain systems that have evolved over millions of years that can accurately read other people's emotions very quickly and very effortlessly. The problem is that we've never been trained how to pay attention to this, these signals, these, this information, so it never really makes it into our consciousness. So we teach people how to read emotional data fields because emotions are data, just like everything else. They're fat, they're fleeting and fast, but it's still data. And it, we are very, very good at reading that. And then when the emotions pop into your consciousness, then we say, all right, now reflect that emotion to the speaker using a you statement. So I would say, Toby, you're really angry. Man, you are really pissed. You don't feel appreciated. You don't feel listened to. You don't feel heard. You're really frustrated. It's really making you anxious. And you're really sad because you feel abandoned and unloved. I kind of went through all the layers. And that, it's just those simple you statements. And you just keep, you tell me a little more and I, more emotions, and I just keep labeling those emotions, reflecting back. That's all I say. I don't do anything else other than just reflect back the emotions. And I'm waiting for you to do something. I'm waiting for you to nod your head, to say yeah or exactly, to drop your shoulders, and to a sigh of relief, exhale, all involuntary and unconscious. Those are the unconscious reflexive responses that show that there's been a relaxation response because you've been validated and deeply heard. And at that point in time, you're probably de-escalated. The whole process takes between 30 and 45 seconds for most people. It really, I mean, people who are really have a lot of emotion obviously can go a lot longer. But for the most, the average person who's super emotional, you can get them calmed down quickly because that's how our brains are hardwired. So now, the trick is learning how to ignore the words because that goes against everything we were taught at 2 years old. How to listen to emotions because we've never learned that skill before. We've never used that aspect of our brain before. So we have to learn how to do that. And then the most challenging part is learning how to do a you statement. Because if anybody's taken any active listening classes, they've learned all about I statements. Well, that is all wrong. It's based on the work of active listening was invented by Roger Gordon, who was a mid-1960s psychologist. And people misinterpreted what he was doing. He was good. He was really good at what he was doing. He knew how to listen. He didn't have affect labeling. He didn't have the science we have today. But he intuited how it should be done. But the people that watched him completely misunderstood what he was doing. And so they got into this whole I statement stuff, which persists to this day in mediation training and therapy training. And I just can't believe it. Don't get me going on that. I'll start to rant.
So the you statement
becomes really important, because when you say you, then it's all focused on you. If I say I, then it's focused on me. And your brain doesn't work the same way when I say you as opposed to when I say I. The other problem with the other challenge is that we're not used to, we've been taught since we were two not to interrupt. And so, but you're not interrupting. The problem with interrupting is you're applying the wrong rule. We're not having a conversation when we're listening. Listening is not conversation. It's something completely different. In conversation, it's never about me. It's about you, the speaker. So my job is to reflect back your emotions as they come up, as you're telling your story or whatever is going on. And that means that I'm going to be doing that frequently. I'll even stop you when you're, you're really X. Yeah. Well, then that, okay. And then they keep going on. As it turns out, the more you reflect the emotion, the more people want to tell you because they feel safe. And the last problem that people have to overcome is they have to overcome the fear of being patronizing or rude or impertinent, because our culture is so anti-emotion. And the idea of telling somebody what they're experiencing emotionally just seems to violate every norm of behavior that we have, which is not true. And furthermore, the norm of behavior that says that we shouldn't be talking about emotions is based on a 4,000-year-old myth that's a lie. And philosophers and theologians, going back before Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, and perpetrated by Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, who was a Neoplatonist, who brought in Neoplatonism to design the Catholic theology, to Immanuel Kant, to the Enlightenment philosophers, all said wrongly that human beings, what makes us different from other species is rationality. Totally false. And that simple idea has led to more abuse in human history than we can possibly imagine. What we know from neuroscience today is that we humans are 98% emotional and only 2% rational. We can't even be rational unless we're emotional first. Everything we do is emotional. And the other thing that's really interesting is we humans are the only species that have emotion. When you properly define emotion, most people, you ask them what's an emotion, they don't know. They can't define it. But if you have a proper definition of emotion, you realize that what makes us human is our emotions, not our rationality. We do have moments of rationality, but we're not Spocks. We're not Vulcans. Not even close. And when we live in a society that denies our emotionality, that means that when I help you by reflecting back your emotions, there is a taboo against doing that, which we have to overcome. And so it takes some courage to do that. And once you overcome it, then you realize and you experience the power of this. Then it becomes a self-affirming practice. It's self-reinforcing, because people are so grateful that you have listened them into existence. And you get that gratitude from them, and it's just really a deeply satisfying experience. And you want to keep doing it. So you do keep doing it. And so that's why the practice becomes self-affirming and self-strengthening as you do more and more and more of it.
And it sounds like a lot different than, you know, maybe a typical conversation structure that you might hear, where it's like, you know, okay, I'm going to talk about my problems for a minute. Now it's your turn. Talk.
Exactly.
Like, right. Where it's like, you're not really actually like listening and having a conversation. You're more just like venting, taking turns venting.
Pretty much.
Like what you're talking about is like where you're not thinking about when the other person's talking, you're not thinking about, you know, what am I going to have for dinner later tonight, or, you know, what movie am I going to watch, whatever. You're almost trying to figure out what emotions that other person is feeling.
I'm totally focused on their emotional experience. Totally focused, to the exclusion of everything else. And what's really cool about that is that when you are that focused on emotions, it's like a bubble forms around you. And anything they say cannot hurt you, cannot penetrate you. You become soft and vulnerable to be strong and powerful. And it works. And the other thing that happens is that you become egoless. So you've probably heard of Eckhart Tolle, and he writes about the power of now. The problem with Eckhart Tolle's work, as many other spiritual teachers, is they tell you what to do, but not how to do it, right? And he's the same way as everybody. But here's, you have this experience of being present, the power of the presence of now. You experience being in the present now, and you experience a transcendent state of egolessness while you're in this process for the 20 or 30 seconds you're in it. And that changes you. It really changes you after you've practiced it for a while, for the better. I mean, it's a really deep transformative change. And you have a lot more compassion, a lot more wisdom. You can look at people and understand what's going on without judgment. And it allows you to deal with all kinds of situations, both good and not so good, with equanimity and inner peace and calm. And you're never at a loss at what to say. So a common example, somebody, let's say that somebody loses a parent. I'm kind of in that generation now where parents are dying, or a brother, or somebody dies who's close. What do you, how do you, we're never properly taught how to listen to and work with somebody who's in deep grief. We'll say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear of your loss, or something like that. First of all, it's a nice statement. Second of all, I'm really not listening. So with this skill, you can say, you are really, really sad. You have a lot of grief. And you're kind of angry. A little pissed off, because people are. And you say, and you feel completely abandoned. And you're anxious. And you feel unloved and unlovable. And that has a much more profound effect on the grieving person, positively, than the stupid stuff, expressions of sympathy that we think are the right things to say. So the beauty of it is, of this is once you master this, it doesn't matter what the situation is. It can be profound grief, profound anger, rage, and everything in between. Or even joyous happiness. You do this and it works just as well. And you know exactly what to say and how to say it to get to listen somebody into existence.
How does this carry over to say like dating and relationships? I would think like everything.
It is amazing. I when I teach my graduate classes, I tell the young women in the class, don't go out to the bar tonight and do this. Use this skill unless you want to use a crowbar to get the guy off you, because you create instant intimacy. And sure enough, there's always a couple of young women who go out and come back the next day a little hungover and just regale us with how they started to affect label guys in the bars, and they couldn't get rid of the guys. The guys instantly fell in love with them because they were able to create emotional safety and listen these guys into existence in a way they've never been heard before, never been listened to before. And it creates instant emotional intimacy. So it's pretty fun. If you really want to build a deep relationship, this is the skill that does it. And I didn't have these skills in my first marriage. I have these skills. In fact, I was just developing these skills at the end of my first marriage. I am married to the most amazing woman on the planet, in my opinion. You know, we never fight. We never argue. We have no conflict. Zero. And it's all because we both use these skills with each other. And we don't get reactive. We don't get defensive. We're very, very intimate, emotionally intimate. And it just makes for an I never believed that marriage could be like it is. And it's unbelievable because of the skills.
So what, besides that sort of, what is that technique called? Like the emotional
ethic leveling?
Affect labeling. Besides affect labeling, what else would you say as far as being some of the most important concepts in terms of peacemaking or just getting along with other people?
Well, obviously listening, knowing there are four different levels of listening. So mastering all of those, I can just go through them very quickly. So we have mirroring, which is where you repeat back word for word what another person is saying. Now, you would never use mirroring for de-escalating or reflecting if somebody's upset. Mirroring is very powerful when you and the speaker have to be on the same page about a rule or a procedure or a list or a checklist of things to be done. So for example, I'm a pilot, and if I get an instrument clearance from the air traffic control, the air traffic controller gives me the clearance, then I have to mirror back that clearance word for word perfectly so that we both know that what's going to happen next, because at 8,000 feet and 200 miles an hour, crushed aluminum is not a good thing. So there has to be perfect accuracy. That's why if you watch the space, you know, if you watch the launches, and you'll always see this call and response kind of process. And that's mirroring, to be very clear, so that people are very clear about what's happening. Then you have paraphrasing, which we're all familiar with. It's the idea of listening to the words that are being spoken and rephrasing them or summarizing them in your own words. And then the third level is core messaging. And in core messaging, we're not going to listen to the words as much. What we're looking for is meaning. And you use core messaging with people who are those people who just go on and on and on and on. They're like a little bunny rabbit running around in a forest, and they don't seem to be going. They just keep talking and talking and talking, and you can't figure out what the point of what it is they're trying to say. And what they're trying to do is they're verbalizing as a thought process to try to figure out what they're trying to say. And so when you core message, basically you are picking up on what they're really trying to say, what their meaning is, and then you reflect back that meaning with a metaphor. And then you've got affect labeling. So peacemakers have to have these four levels of listening skills, and they have to be dialed in so it's automatic and habitual. Then the next thing you need to have are problem-solving tools. And typically in mediation, you know, it involves negotiation. So you have to be a really good, strong negotiator, and you have to understand negotiation theory, and you also have to understand decision-making theory. That's why I teach the class, decision-making under stress and uncertainty. You have to understand when you're in a peacemaking situation, oftentimes people have to make a choice amongst bad decisions. None of them are good. And they've got to figure out which one's the least worst. That's tough. And as a peacemaker, you've got to help people through that decision-making process. There are different kinds of negotiation that you might utilize. In legal negotiation and litigated disputes, we use a process known as distributive negotiation. That's like the kind of like the back in the old days, the Henry Kissinger shuttle diplomacy. You've probably heard that term. Shuttling back and forth, exchanging offers and counteroffers. That's a distributive process. In disputes where money is not quite as important, or there are other issues other than money, you're going to use what's known as integrative negotiation. And that's where or it's also known as interest-based negotiation. And that's a completely different kind of negotiation. And you're going to help people satisfy their needs rather than to try to win a position or make a compromise. And then interest-based negotiation, I tell parties, if you compromise, you're making a mistake. Don't compromise. But you do have to work hard at figuring out how to satisfy the other side's interests as well as getting your own interests satisfied. Because the only way you're going to make a deal is both of you feel like your interests have been satisfied. And so it's a whole different process of figuring out, well, what are those needs? And then what are all the different ways that we can satisfy these needs that make sense to everybody?
Which do you think is the toughest type of communication which out of all of these different skills or techniques that we talked about, do you find it most difficult for people to develop?
Well, obviously, the listening skills are the most difficult. Core messaging and affect labeling. I mean, it's not that it's difficult to learn. It takes about 8 weeks of constant practice to get pretty good at it. It's just that it's so counterintuitive and so counternormative that in the beginning, people have some people have a problem with it. And they have to be coached. That's why I do group coaching, so that people can come once a week to a coaching session and get support and help. None of this is really difficult. It just takes time to learn. And I would say the most difficult thing to learn in peacemaking is how to sit in a room, especially in the beginning, where you got disputants who would rather pull out their AK-47s and shoot each other than talk to each other. And you've got to know how to manage that. And you got to know how to manage yourself, because if you're not careful, that'll trigger a lot of anxiety in yourself. And once you get anxious, then you're done. You're ineffective. So you have to manage your own anxiety.
You were mentioning before, like, following some neuroscience research. Is that like a big part of you understanding these different concepts or teaching them? Do you oftentimes utilize that research?
Interesting question. I study the literature and read the studies because I want to understand at a fundamental level how these different events are occurring in the human brain. So, for example, we can talk about emotional self-awareness. And that is a skill that has to be developed. It turns out that the ability to be aware of the emotions we're experiencing in the moment is generated in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate gyrus. And that's the part that pops these emotions into consciousness. Well, that's a good thing to know. Just at a fundamental level. Not that it provides you with any useful information in practice, but understanding that everything that we do, everything that we experience, is processed through our brains and through our bodies, our brain-body systems, gives you a deep perspective on what you see in front of you when people are in deep conflict. It's not some chaotic mess. It's biological stuff going on. And if you know a little bit about the biology or the neurophysiology, then one, you have compassion, and two, you can get a sense of, okay, what should I try next and what's really going on. If you don't have that knowledge, it's like you're looking at this black box and you can become mystified about what's going on. The other thing that I always look for in the research is I'm always looking for, neuroscientists are not good at coming up with interventions. That's not their job, right? Their job is to understand, depending on what kind of neuroscientist you are, what chemicals are being transmitted in what way and what quantities and for how long through the synapse and all that stuff. Or, what's the architecture of this part of the brain, or what are the connections? How do the white matter, the nerve connections, how are all they being connected? That's just some great new technology being developed in that area. So they typically get into and really get looking at how many angels dance on the head of a pin kind of stuff, and are not stepping back and looking at it from, okay, so what's the practical application of this stuff? That's my job. To take the research. And think about, what are there practical ramifications in terms of helping people, primarily in the peacemaking mode, helping people really find peace. So that's why I study it.
I would think that oxytocin is probably a big, like,
yeah, I remember
that's being modulated by the work that you're doing.
Yeah, Paul Zak. I know Paul Zak, and you're probably referring to his early studies. And Paul's a great guy. He's at the graduate school, Claremont Graduate School in Southern California. And of course, he did the groundbreaking study that showed that there's a strong relationship between oxytocin and trust. And when that came out, all of us in the mediation field were laughing. I mean, I was the one that kind of introduced it into the mediation field, and because I'd known Paul. And so guys were talking about spraying oxytocin. It comes in a nasal spray because it is used to induce delivery with women. So you can get this stuff in a nasal spray. It's prescribed, of course. But so they're talking about putting it into the air vents and spraying oxytocin into the rooms to build trust. Oh, okay, so understanding a little bit about neurochemistry is useful, but we have to understand that There's no one system that does everything. So oxytocin influences the neural circuits, the neural systems that have to do with all kinds of things, including pair bonding, orgasm, trust, agreeability. But it also works in combinations with serotonin and cortisol and adrenaline. So all of these chemicals work together and oppose. They're antagonists and protagonists, and they all work in this system. But let's just take oxytocin, for example. Why is it that for probably millions of years, in many, many cultures, negotiations would never begin until the parties that are negotiating have sat down and had a meal with each other and have spent hours telling stories to each other about their families? And the reason is, as it turns out, that's a natural way to produce oxytocin. Why are there cultures where people hug? I mean, we don't do that anymore. We don't even shake hands anymore with the pandemic. But it turns out that oxytocin is released when we touch each other. A touch on the shoulder, a shaking of the hand, a hug, that releases oxytocin. It's the natural way to release oxytocin. And when oxytocin levels rise, as Paul's studies show, people are more trusting. When oxytocin levels lower, people are mistrusting. They're not so trusting. So in mediation, we try to set up the environment to promote oxytocin release, if we can, if we have that ability to control that. And we're certainly aware of conditions that will lower oxytocin. Same thing with serotonin. Serotonin, of course, is a kind of a universal neurochemical, all kinds of functions, but one of the functions is to relax and calm down. So serotonin or 5-HTP, which is the precursor, which you can buy at any drugstore, any market, 5-hydroxytryptophan will boost your serotonin levels. And it's a poor man's Prozac, fluoxetine, right? It puts more Prozac in the synapse. There's a great study, since we're on the subject of serotonin, a great study done years ago where neuroscientists were studying hormone levels in relationship to leadership and prime apes. So they had a troop of macaque monkeys, and they found the alpha male, and they chemically reduced his serotonin levels. Within 2 days, he was ostracized from the troop, and everybody was throwing monkey feces at him. So they gave him 5-HTP, and 3 days later, he was the alpha male again, and all the girls loved him. Then they did a study that looked at serotonin levels versus stock market pricing, and they found that CEOs with high serotonin levels had led companies that generally did much, much better in the stock market than the alpha males that the movies portray. So pretty interesting stuff. So if you're going, if as a mediator, you want to have high serotonin levels. And if you're dealing with people in your room, you want them to have high serotonin levels, but you can't give them too much or they'll fall asleep. So it's a constant balance. So yeah, knowing about the effects of neurohormones on people's processing is important. Understanding, for example, the limitations of the prefrontal cortex and decision making, that it can be diverted very easily, very quickly. And what happened 2 days ago to a person is going to affect their decision making today. And that's something, as a mediator, I have no control over, but I watch for it. And maybe there are some interventions I can do that will help people be able to work with decision making in a way that makes sense to them. So these are all the different little nuanced ways that understanding how the brain-body system works, polyvagal system. So how the brain creates all this stuff, how does it get transmitted to the rest of the body? It's through what's known as the polyvagal system, the vagus nerves, two systems. This is the work of Stephen Porges. And understanding the polyvagal system is really, really important for a whole bunch of different reasons. So for example, tonality, voice speed, that's where most information is conveyed. It's not conveyed by the words. Only 7% is conveyed by words. The rest of the information is nonverbal. Well, what controls tonality? Vocal cords and the hypoglossal muscles and all that. That is connected, comes up through, those are nerves, hypoglossal nerves that come up, connect into the part of the vagus nerve, come into the brain at the brainstem, and then distribute into the emotional centers of the brain. And it turns out that, like all mammals, if you have a high voice, indicates fear, and a low voice indicates calm. If you are confronting an angry person, the last thing you want to do is use a high voice up here like this, because it shows weakness. And for an angry person, they don't want weakness, they want strength, they want safety. So you enrich the timbre of your voice and speak out of your belly and drop down a little bit. I'm not really lowering the pitch, but I'm creating more timbre and a deeper, more resonant voice. And because of the polyvagal system, the speaker's ears will pick that up and they'll calm down. So just knowing this stuff is just part of the art of knowing how to be a peacemaker. And of course, diplomats don't know any of this. They're not trained in this. They think they're peacemakers. They really aren't. I wrote a whole book critiquing the international diplomatic community. Why is it the United Nations has a success rate of less than 4% of bringing peace in the conflicts? That's because the people they sent in don't know what they're doing.
So what are the typical mistakes made by conflict negotiators or peacemakers? What are they getting wrong?
They don't have any of the skills that I've been talking about, first of all. And second, they typically try to solve problems when a mediator's job is not to solve the problem. Mediator's job is to help the people solve the problem themselves and hold their feet to the fire. They're emotionally averse, and they can't stand the heat of strong emotions, most mediators and peacemakers. And they want to keep everything on a rational basis.
Which isn't appealing to people the emotional appeal.
Yeah, you can't solve emotional problems with rationality. You can't. And there's no conflict that isn't highly emotional. So if you try to use rationality to help people solve an emotional problem, you're doomed to failure. And that's the way most diplomats, because the diplomatic system is based on a theory of rationality developed way back in a treaty called the Treaty of Westphalia back in the 1600s. And it's antiquated, and it's no longer efficient, as we can tell. I mean, we've got these rogue nations out there, and appealing to their rationality, or even appealing to their emotions. I mean, it's a really good approach, is carrot-stick approach. Sanctions and pound you over the head, but here, come get this. That's probably the only way you can deal with nation states that are going rogue.
So Doug, we're coming up on the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you, where do you see yourself applying this sort of work going forward in the future? And I guess also, obviously the pandemic, COVID, has affected everyone, but has it changed anything as far as, obviously our world is being faced with, this huge conflict that, we obviously, all of the skills I feel like that you talked about are more important than ever. So I just wanted to kind of get your take on that too.
Right. I, as I said, these are foundational skills. And for the time I have remaining on this planet, and as long as I'm healthy, I want to do two things. I want to teach as many people as possible how to do this. And I want to teach those who feel called to it how to do what I do. Not only how to be a peacemaker, but more importantly, how to teach other people to listen. And this is all so new. To my knowledge, I'm the only person out there talking about this stuff. I haven't come across anybody, and I'm pretty well known in my field. I haven't come across anybody who talks about all of this in the way that I am. So I'm one man. I don't have an entourage. I don't have a huge organization. I don't have billions of dollars. I work on my 10-acre ranch in Central California. I have a lovely place to live, and I have the beauty of a high-speed internet. I can talk to anybody in the world anytime I want. And I'm trying to build a platform to educate people about this. And a certain percentage of people that hear this show, for example, I think will be motivated to reach out to me or go to my website and start learning. Not everybody is called to this. But I learned in the prison project that all we have to do is teach 1% of the inmates on a yard, 10 men on a yard out of 1,000 men, and the whole yard will change within a year. That's all it takes. So I'm really interested in working with people, that 1%, those people who somehow, for some reason, what I talk about resonates with them, and they say, I want to learn more about this. And those people I want to teach, and of that group, a small percentage will want to be teachers too, and I want to teach them how to teach. And that's kind of my goal, serving humanity in this very deep and profound way.
Awesome. And if those people who do connect to what we were just talking about, where would you direct them to if they want to connect with you or find out more information?
Right. My website is really easy, DougKnoll.com, DougKnoll.com. Email Doug@DougKnoll.com, not too hard. From my website, I have dozens of articles and blogs. Right now I have two courses in emotional competency. Each course is under $200. I got a comment from a guy in India earlier this week who said every human being on the planet should take this course. So the students are really finding it to be a very profound and deep course. And I priced it so that just about everybody can afford it. So you can find the courses, and I'm actually going to be releasing a negotiation course probably later this year. And my book, Deescalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. There are links on the website for that, but you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or any bookstore, online bookstore is going to carry the book. And the Audible version is out, read by my wife, so that's kind of fun. So you can get the Audible version. And if you read German, you can get the German version. If you are Arabic, you can get the Arabic version. If you're Mandarin, you can get the Mandarin version. It's in three languages plus English. And then just reach out. I recommend that people buy the book. You know, if you're an Amazon Prime member, I think you can get it for like $11 or $12, including shipping. And read the book and then reach out to me. If you're resonating with it, fire me off an email and we'll have a Zoom call and talk about it.
Great. And for those of you guys who did enjoy the show, go ahead and like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're Roscoe's Wetsuit Neuro. And you can also find audio versions of the podcast available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and just about anywhere else that audio podcasts are available. Doug, again, I wanted to really thank you for coming on the show today and sharing your wealth of knowledge and expertise. So thank you.